pleasure and an honor to be here in looking at the eminent speakers that you've had, which I was unable to attend because of my commute, and the speakers that have even given concurrent sessions, I feel a little overawed. On the other hand, since many of our concurrent breakout sessions will probably be overlapping in content, just looking at their names, so I don't mind if I repeat what somebody else is saying in the other room, because you're not hearing what somebody else is saying in the other room, so that should be okay. The issue I want to address, or the issue I was asked to address, is what a Jewish person needs to know about durable powers of attorney, living wills, do not resuscitate orders, and the like. So first, if with your indulgence, I'm going to switch hats from my black rabbinic hat to my hat as an attorney, and first sketch out the legal background that you need to know, because you can only evaluate the halachic response if you have a sense of what is the state of legal rules regarding this area under the law of the United States. The single most important case to be aware of, there have been a number of cases on the Supreme Court level, but the Cruzan case, going back to the mid-80s, is a very important case. This involved a young woman that was in a coma in the aftermath of an automobile accident. She was capable of breathing on her own. She was not a respirator-dependent patient, but like Terry Schiavo years later, she was getting hydration and nutrition through artificial feeding because she was in a persistent vegetative state. After a considerable amount of time, her parents petitioned the courts in Missouri to discontinue feeding and hydration on the grounds that this is what she would have wanted. She would not have wanted to live life in that particular way. The Supreme Courts, well, the courts of Missouri took the position that because she did not leave a living will or an advance directive, this type of life support could be discontinued only if there is clear and convincing evidence that this was her wish. And since she didn't have clear and convincing evidence, the feeding tubes had to remain. The Supreme Court did affirm that, but what's most important about the case is not its affirming, but what the court said in dicta. Dicta means remarks that were not necessary for the holding. And what the Supreme Court said is, if a patient has left an advance directive stating that they do not want certain life support, there is a constitutional requirement that those wishes be obeyed. Those of you that might be pre-law know that by declaring that something is a constitutional requirement, that means the states are bound. The states could not pass a law to the contrary. Essentially, Cruzan constitutionalized, as a matter of privacy, the same right to privacy upon which the abortion right is supposedly based in Roe versus Wade, that there's a constitutional right that a patient has to decline unwanted medical treatment. And that can be made not only in terms of the individual bedside treatment decisions, but that could be made in advance through a living will, an advance directive, as the term is often called. Now, let me point out that Cruzan has a number of chidushim in this regard. Chidush number one, again, this is not the language the Supreme Court used, but chidush number one is there is no distinction between a terminal patient and a non-terminal patient. A terminal patient is a person whose death is imminent, whose death is going to be expected very soon. Well, we'll try to define that a little later on with more precision. In the case of Cruzan, she could have been kept alive, just as Terry Schiavo, for many years on artificial hydration and nutrition. Now, before the Supreme Court, courts would say, well, you have a right to decline life-sustaining treatment if you're going to die in the next month or so. But certainly, if someone has a prospect for staying at least physically alive for a long time, a number of courts did not allow a decision to withdraw medical treatment. But the Supreme Court said, no difference. There is no distinction between terminal and non-terminal. That's chiddush number one that the Supreme Court is telling us. As a matter of American law, we'll see in halakha whether this is true. Chiddush number two, I'm using kind of the yeshiva terminology here, because you do have to, unfortunately, analyze these opinions with a great deal of care. Chiddush number two is there is no distinction between hydration and nutrition and any other medical procedure. There used to be a consensus, even in the medical community, that feeding and nutrition, even if it's delivered mechanically, was the normal process of sustaining life, and that's to be distinguished from surgery, chemotherapy, and even respirators, which are extraordinary invasive interventions, as opposed to feeding. Supreme Court said, nope, we don't make a difference between hydration, nutrition, and the other medical procedure. Hydration and nutrition is a medical procedure, and therefore it is subsumed within the living will situation. So these are two very, very important points in which the Supreme Court constitutionalized the right of a non-terminal patient, even a non-terminal patient, to have hydration and nutrition discontinued. Oh, yes, and finish number three is the Supreme Court rejected the distinction between not providing it in the first place and discontinuing it once it's there. Again, some courts used to take the position that a patient has the right to decline a treatment being initiated, but once they're on the machine, once they have the system, to discontinue would be akin to a suicide. Supreme Court said no. So note that according to this position, the right legally under American law of patient autonomy is almost absolute. Even if you're non-terminal, even if it's hydration and nutrition, and even if the hydration and nutrition system is already there, the patient has the absolute right to have it discontinued. Even in a case like Terry Schiavo, the only reason, I mean, Terry Schiavo happens 100 times a day. The only reason why Terry Schiavo had any controversy at all is only because different family members were on different sides of the case. Husband wanted one thing, parents wanted something else. But, you know, the concept of people being pulled off feeding and dying as a result of starvation, that's nothing unusual. You walk into, particularly in the state of Florida, Florida is not a good place. I mean, in a way, it's kind of cruel that old people go to Florida. It's not a good place to be old, actually, because there are tremendous pressures there to get people off life support and the like, but other states as well. So the Cruzan case, now again, Cruzan herself didn't have a living will, so there were some issues over there, and even then, four judges ought to, you know, were willing to kind of assume this is what she would have wanted, etc. It resurfaced in the Terry Schiavo issue as well. But the point is that the Supreme Court basically gave tremendous prominence and importance to the document that is called a living will or an advance directive by recognizing that a properly executed living will is a constitutional obligation on the state to obey the provisions of that will, even for non-terminal patients, even for hydration and nutrition, and even to discontinue existing systems that are already in place. Now, the next logical extension of that would be physician-assisted suicide, and indeed the Second Circuit and the Ninth Circuit originally took the position, hey, if I have the right to have life support discontinued, why don't I have the right to have Jack Kevorkian inject me with some poison to allow me to die? And there were courts that did take the position that the same logic that allows the withdrawal of life support would also create a constitutional right to assisted suicide. The Supreme Court did apply a break to that. The Supreme Court did say that although the Constitution protects you from unwarranted medical intervention, the Constitution does not give you a right to actively enlist somebody in terminating your life. Now, that doesn't mean the states can't do it individually. Oregon, in fact, has legitimated various forms of physician-assisted suicide. So states might do it. There is a right to die movement in the United States, but the Supreme Court at least said it is not constitutionally required. States are allowed to do this. Whether ethically there is a meaningful distinction between shutting off a machine and getting injected with something that kills you is still a very, very difficult question. Sins of omission versus sins of commission. But nevertheless, legally, there is such a distinction, and as I will show, halacha more or less recognizes a similar distinction as well. If we were to summarize what is the philosophical predicate of the living will movements, it is one word, and that is autonomy. You know, I come from Washington, D.C., and one of the leading medical ethics centers in the United States is that connected to Georgetown University. Georgetown, more or less, well, at least that's what we say in Washington, kind of invented medical ethics as a secular discipline. And they reiterate ad nauseum the four principles of the Georgetown Medical Ethics School, and that's called the Georgetown Mantra. And they say medical ethics is based on four principles. It is based on the principle of beneficence, try to do what is in the patient's best interest; non-maleficence, do no harm; autonomy, respect the patient's decisions as a free-willed individual; and the fourth is a concern for distributive justice in terms of allocating resources in a fair way. Now, these principles are in hopeless conflict because often patient autonomy might be something that's not in the patient's best interest. And it's absolutely clear under American law that although the Georgetown Mantra has four principles, there is one principle that is the 800-pound or 8,000-pound elephant, and that is autonomy. There is absolutely no question that a patient under American law has the right to go to hell in a handbasket, and whatever is in his best interest is totally subservient to a determination of autonomy. That's what a living will does, unless the patient is incompetent or the like. And even then, typically decisions are made based on the fact that what would the patient want rather than what is objectively in the patient's best interest. Now let me start at the outset, switching hats to halacha for a moment, that it's very, very clear that if autonomy is the cornerstone of American medical ethics, autonomy in Jewish medical ethics has a role, but a much less dominant role. There was a classic essay by Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin Zatzal, one of the great Talmidei Chachamim and one of the fantastic writers in virtually anything he wrote about, in which he discusses Mishpat Shylock Laor Halacha. If you go to Shakespeare and you remember The Merchant of Venice, where Shylock, the Jewish moneylender — of course, there were no Jews in England for a few hundred years, but you know, this is Shakespeare's famous portrayal. There's still an argument whether it's a positive portrayal or a negative portrayal. That's a whole discussion, I'm sure. In a Torah Umada institution, you'll discuss those types of aspects. But Rabbi Zevin analyzes, according to strict halacha, what would the din be if a lender stipulated, if you don't pay me back on time, I'll do some medieval liposuction and take my pound of flesh? So Rabbi Zevin concludes from many, many sources that not only is mutilation prohibited, there is a general prohibition against mutilation, but even in terms of monetary and property rights, you could not enter into such an agreement, because the same way I can't borrow money and give somebody a mortgage on your house or Bill Gates' house — if I could, my credit would be much better than it is, because it's not mine, that which is not mine, I cannot pledge to my creditor — in many ways, halacha does not recognize ownership over my body. Quoting the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, who's a great, great posek as well, a person's guf is kinyano shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It is God's property. It is given to us on loan. That's why there are laws regarding taking care of our health. There are laws, there are even discussions in Poskim regarding the permissibility of elective cosmetic surgery, where I simply want to change my nose or whatever it would be, not because of a burn or anything like that. And you know, there is a discussion. It's not so obvious that those types of decisions are going to be permitted. So the notion that I'm allowed to commit suicide or I'm allowed to simply decide to stop living, halacha does not automatically accept that. See, that's why in Anglo-American law, you'll find, if you read 1,000 medical ethics cases, you will find that the discussion in Anglo-American law is always about who makes the decision. The patient, if they're competent; if they're not competent, we have family members or a designated person in the power of attorney. Meaning, Anglo-American law doesn't care what the decision is. They only care who gets to make it. Because once you've identified the person who makes the decision, usually the patient, but it could be other people as well, so the substance of the decision can be anything. Turn off the machine, let me die, etc. Halacha actually discusses it much more so, not so much who makes the decision. It discusses what the decision should be made. Right? So consequently, autonomy might resolve medical ethics problems insofar as American law is concerned. Autonomy doesn't answer anything insofar as halacha is concerned. Yeah, you make the decision, but what's the decision you're supposed to make? So, as a result, there is, in a sense, an inescapable conflict between living wills and halacha, because living wills are designed to exercise my autonomy in determining which treatments should be discontinued, when in point of fact, these are halachic matters that have to be resolved with halacha. Nevertheless, it does behoove every Jewish person, certainly every religious person, to exercise and execute some type of living will document. And there are different forms these living will documents can take. And first, let me just point out that legally, although even lawyers use the terms interchangeably, you need to differentiate the term living will from what is called a durable power of attorney. Again, even lawyers interchange them, and even as good as Israel, which calls its document a halachic living will, it actually is a durable power of attorney. These are two different things. A living will is a document in which you specify ahead of time what types of treatments you want and what types of treatments you don't want. I'll use Maryland as an example, but New York is substantially the same idea. You might say, for example, that if I'm in a coma, a persistent vegetative state, and there's no reasonable prospect I'll come out of it, I want my hydration and nutrition to be discontinued. Or you might say, I want hydration and nutrition, but no respirator. Or you might say, I even want breathing, but I don't want surgery if that became necessary, or antibiotics. In other words, you can be very specific, and you kind of articulate ahead of time which treatments will be provided, which treatments will not be provided. And this typically covers either terminal situations, or it covers persistent vegetative states, or it covers things like Lou Gehrig's disease, which are not terminal in the sense you can live for a few years, but in which there's a total loss of function and the like. Now, a durable power of attorney is fundamentally a different concept. A durable power of attorney is a document that says, if I become incapacitated and unable to exercise my judgment, here are the people that I want to exercise my judgment for me. And you know, typically there might be relatives, or it might be a rabbi, or it might be anybody you want. If you don't trust your relatives, there might be other people involved and the like. Now, these are two different things, because a durable power of attorney does not necessarily specify what the decision should be. You're leaving it to the delegate. A living will may not designate some surrogate decision maker. Now, it is entirely possible to combine living will and durable power of attorney and the like. Now, let me point out that for the Orthodox community, there are two documents called living wills that are out there that are premised on very different assumptions. Agudas Israel of America, your neighbor a little further down the street here, basically has a document called Halachic Living Will that you can access from jlaw.com, a Jewish law website. And they've even gone to the trouble of preparing the formalities of every state, you know, notarization, in other words. So you can actually download a New York halachic living will. But if you look at the Agudas Israel living will, it is totally a durable power of attorney. It does not provide any particular treatments, modalities. It simply says, it is my wish that all treatment decisions shall be made in accordance with halacha, and the halachic authority who shall make these determinations is Rabbi so-and-so, and if he is not available, Rabbi so-and-so. And the purpose of the Aguda living will, as they call it, although it's a power of attorney, is not to, for you to determine ahead of time whether you want life support or not, but to simply ensure that the physicians and the hospitals will be making decisions in accordance with the posek that you have discussed. Now, obviously, you don't pick your posek from the yellow pages, as it were, and obviously you talk to your posek ahead of time so you understand what the parameters are. But many people do find the Aguda form very disappointing in the sense that you're not really making any decisions at all. You are simply passing the buck for the rabbi to make the decision when the time comes. Now, in defense of Aguda, and I'll try to allude to this, Aguda's position is, as many poskim will say, that the case-by-case determinations that need to be made when people are facing serious illness cannot really be predicted or articulated ahead of time. it wouldn't be possible to spell out, I don't want life support if I get a coma, because it would depend on many factors. I'll talk about that later. Therefore, the best you can do is kind of say, when push comes to shove, Rabbi so-and-so is going to be the one that will postulate on it. And again, hopefully you should have a discussion with Rabbi so-and-so so you know what the parameters are. I'll tell you this. One of the dilemmas that, let's say, I guess I'm still a relatively younger rabbi, that younger rabbis, although rapidly leaving that category, but that younger rabbis have, is sometimes we may not want to always take the ultimate responsibility for an end-of-life decision-making. So a person might ask us, so who should we ask? Now, I can give people different names, a number of whom are on this campus. The problem is, since their positions are so well-known, in effect, I'm just to give you an example. I mean, I'll mention name. I mean, the issue of brain death, which is, you know, so as you know, you're like, what? Absolutely not. You know, brain death, the person is alive, and it's Ritzicha. Rabbi Tendler, as you heard, brain death is death. So, if I tell a person to ask Rabbi Gleick or ask Rabbi Tendler, I'm paskening the shadow. Because I know what Rabbi Tendler will say. I know what Rabbi Gleick will say. So I have to find an eminent post-site because Jews I don't know yet and say, you know, Rabbi David Cohen or someone like that, you know, go ahead and ask. But the issue is this. But the aguda form is that you cannot make these decisions ahead of time. So the best you can do is a durable power of attorney, which they call halakha living will. Now, the alternative form that you will find in the Orthodox community was prepared by the RCA, the Rabbinical Council of America, together with the OU, and it was approved by Rabbi Tendler. And if you ever look at the OU form, although it does, of course, have the rabbi who should paskin these matters, but you'll also notice it's a more proactive document because it does allow the patient to specify which treatments should be applied, which not. In a sense, though, it's a little misleading because it is still constructed so there's a rabbinic veto, meaning the patient states preferences, but within the document it says, but if the posek who is chosen feels these are not halakhically proper, so then they shall not be implemented and the rabbi's psak shall be final. So, in a sense, the difference between the two documents is not quite as great as you might assume. The aguda does not give the patient the autonomy to make those decisions. The OU form does, but quite properly it provides a rabbinic veto. You'll also notice in the OU form a very interesting thing, in which you can certainly see the hand, the very skilled hand of Rabbi Tendler, the learned hand of Rabbi Tendler, in which it does say it does have a provision for the authorization of removal of vital organs upon a determination of brain death, which is based on Rav Tendler's psak, that brain death is halachic death, and therefore organ donation is not only permitted, but would even be a mitzvah, as it were. Suffice it to say, the aguda form does not have any authorization for organ donation based on the view of their poskim, that at least a determination of brain death would not justify the removal of a vital organ. Again, there's so much to talk about here. Just since I mentioned brain death, I just want to be sure that everybody fully understands, and I'm sure you do, but just to reiterate the obvious, that a clinical brain death is not the same as a persistent vegetative state. A patient in a persistent vegetative state in a coma lacks higher cerebral function, but they are 1,000% alive, halakhically and legally. And nobody would say you could remove organs. If you were to remove an organ from Terry Schiavo, that would be murder even under Florida law. So that's not the issue. The debate between Rabbi Bleich, Rabbi Tendler, and many, many poskim is not about people in deep comas. It's about people whose brain stem has become non-functional. And the argument is including respiratory centers and the like. Remember, Terry Schiavo was not on a respirator. And there the machlokas is life defined by circulation of blood, or is life defined by some functionality of the brain stem? That's a machlokas. But do not confuse that, because the reason I bring up, which is really an obvious point, but I bring it up because in the popular press, we often refer, or reporters often refer to people in comas as vegetables or as brain dead people. And the like, and technically, it's very important in these halakhic debates that you keep these views very, very different. So at a minimum, I'm not here to push the OU form or the aguda form. But certainly the one thing that you definitely want to ensure is that when decisions have to be made, they will be made in accordance with halacha. That is necessary for two reasons. It is necessary, number one, because as religious Jews, we are committed to halacha. That's the most important reason. But reason number two, which might be secondary, but it's also important, is by having a posek involved and by having halakhic standards employed, that relieves the family themselves of a tremendous amount of guilt and ambivalence. End-of-life decision-making is emotionally very, very rough. And of course it is. And there's no question that people feel sorrow no matter which alternative they go with. If they elect to keep people alive at all costs, there's a great deal of sorrow because they feel that perhaps we're causing extra pain and suffering. And if they terminate life supports, I'm talking about just generally, then there's a great feeling, I may have killed my parent. So in addition to the sorrow, there is also a tremendous amount of guilt. What this type of living will or a consultation with a posek does is, by ensuring that the decisions are made in accordance with the objective standards of the Torah, that's not going to take away the sorrow. Of course there's sorrow. But at least there's nothing to be guilty. We did the will of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And as a result, even therapeutically, it's a tremendous feeling. In fact, you'll find outside of the religious community, you'll often find this ambivalence in how aggressively parents should be treated. I've seen this more than once, in which somebody's on life support and you typically had one child, or usually it happens to be a daughter, who's been investing, you know, years and years in taking care of this parent. And all of a sudden, when a decision has to be made, somebody from South Dakota shows up who hasn't spoken to her mother for 25 years and says, "You're not going to kill my mother." All of a sudden, she becomes the great aggressive caregiver. And you get all of these ambivalences where people are guilty over the neglect they had for their parents all those years, and now they want to come and be the white knight that fixes it up. I mean, these are dysfunctional relationships that are playing out in end of life. When you have the halakhic living will, you at least have the structure that enables those types of issues to be bypassed. Now, in terms of actual decisions that a Rav makes, let's take DNR as an example, do not resuscitate. Well, again, all I can tell you is, this is something that you have to discuss with your posek. For example, if you take Rabbi Bleich's position, and Rabbi Bleich, again, a Talmid Chacham from whom I have unbounded admiration, but some of his positions are minority positions in this matter. Rabbi Bleich adopts the position that because, which in a way is very logical in a sense, because pikuach nefesh is the cardinal value of the Torah, his point is life must be preserved no matter what its duration, no matter what extent of pain. And of course he doesn't agree with brain death either, so even brain death he considers to be a chiyuv to sustain life. And therefore, Rabbi Bleich says, there's little or no... I'm sorry, did I drop some? So his position is that other than a durable power of attorney, there is little or no utility in a living will because there's nothing you could ever specify be discontinued. He makes a few exceptions. Even Rabbi Bleich has a few exceptions. He says you can pray that somebody should be taken out of their misery, which is kind of funny in a theological sense, because you're doing everything you can to keep somebody alive, and you're praying to Hashem that your efforts should fail. But that's one thing he says. Another very important exception he has is that he does regard the administration of pain medication as a permissible medical intervention, even though it incrementally increases the risk of someone dying, such as morphine that could repress respiratory activity. But other than that, he would not countenance any type of withdrawal of life support. Now, I have to say that this is Rabbi Bleich's position, and of course it is grounded in Pikuach Nefesh, but many other poskim, including Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, contemporarily, of course, Rav Tedler, take a view that at least in cases of extreme pain and suffering, when there is no curative or therapeutic benefit, to the intervention. Interventions may be discontinued. Again, in Rav Moshe's early tshuvos, however, he did say hydration and nutrition cannot be discontinued. So it's very interesting that Rav Moshe's tshuvos did reflect, or they were the same position as the medical profession itself before Kruzan. Kruzan obliterated the distinction between hydration, nutrition, and medical procedure. Rav Moshe Feinstein's tshuvos seem to affirm that distinction. There are some poskim, however, who are even more lenient, and they do allow even the discontinuation of hydration and nutrition, at least if it's provided mechanically or through tube feedings, on the grounds that that also is a medical procedure. Again, I'm not here at all to poskim this. All I want to say is that what is identified as the vitalist position, which means physical life must be sustained regardless of pain, is actually a minority position in the halachic tradition, and halacha does recognize the ability to discontinue medical treatments in the face of great pain, at least when the condition is terminal and you're only dealing with what is called chaye sha'ar. Now, by the way, that creates an interesting paradox, and that is, the paradox is, there may be a duty to be more aggressive in the treatment of people in comas than for people who are awake. That is, people who are awake, like pancreatic cancer, who are suffering tremendously, yesurin may be a halachic basis not to force them to undergo chemotherapy. Paradoxically, the comatose patient who may not be feeling pain, the imperative of pikuach nefesh would be stronger. In other words, the imperative of pikuach nefesh is stronger when you don't have a countervailing pain situation. Now, this is a matter of controversy because we're not entirely sure what persistent vegetative patients actually feel, and people come in and out of these states as well. But that's why, for example, in Teri Scheibe, because she wasn't Jewish, so a lot of these halachas don't apply, but ignoring that fact for a moment, number one, Teri Scheibe involved the withdrawal of hydration and nutrition, which according to Rav Moshe wouldn't be permitted. Number two, Teri Scheibe was not chaye sha'a because she was not in a terminal condition. And number three, if we assume that PVS patients do not suffer physical pain, you don't have the hedger of Yisuri, right? So because of all of those different reasons, halacha would probably not support the discontinuation of life support. Okay, so these are complicated issues, and a posek needs to be consulted about them. And as I say, people should have conversations. These are hard conversations to have sometimes, but these are conversations that need to be taken. So a DNR may in fact be justified in many situations, particularly when you're dealing with people who are very old and frail. Number one, the DNR at best, DNR in the elderly is a very, very low, I mean, you know, you keep someone alive for 2 minutes and then they go back into it. Number two, it can involve the breaking of ribs and the puncturing of lungs. So you're dealing with chayesha, a very, very short life expectancy after the CPR. You're dealing with suffering and the like. So in many situations, there would be a halachic basis for a DNR, but one needs to talk to a Rav about it. Now, I just want to caution people about the following. A DNR can come in many flavors, but a plain vanilla DNR only means one thing. It means that they're not going to do a cardiopulmonary resuscitation if the heart stops beating. Now, the problem is, in some hospital cultures, and things have gotten better today, a DNR is the same thing as saying, this person's dead, forget about it. Now, that's not true at all. There should be a lot of, even if there's a DNR, even if it's halachically determined that we're not going to pound on this person's chest and break a rib and puncture a lung, nevertheless, there are many interventions that still should be there. Hydration and nutrition should not be discontinued, generally speaking. Pain relief medication, palliative care. There might be antibiotics for cases of infection. So it's extremely important that the family understand exactly what they are discontinuing in a DNR and what will still need to be provided. You can't go with the package deal. It's not like a Chinese menu or whatever it is. You can't just go with the DNR package. You got to unpack every single intervention and determine what is justified and what is not justified halakhically. And that may be very, very different than the standard DNR in the hospital configuration. I want to say, too, as well, that to a large degree, you know, one of the great failures of American medicine historically has been the inadequate treatment of pain management. For many, many years, doctors were trying to treat diseases, but, you know, pain was just considered to be this byproduct of disease. There wasn't a lot they could do. Perhaps it was psychosomatic. Well, of course, it is psychosomatic in a sense, but, you know, it's in your head, or don't think about it. If you remember, we even have stories of people in the last few weeks of life who needed morphine, and they would not be given access to morphine because perhaps they would become addicted. And God forbid that, you know, you should spend the last 2 weeks of your life addicted to morphine. Now, Baruch Hashem, one of the, and of course the whole movement to physician-assisted suicide, surveys have shown that a lot of that movement, and why it got some popularity, is people are horrified, terrified, that they're going to spend the last weeks of their lives in horrendous, uncontrollable pain. And the truth of the matter is, to some degree, that's a false fear, or at least in many cases. Pain management, which has now come into a specialty of its own, a very distinguished specialty, I think has shown that many, many patients can have a reasonably comfortable, not totally pain-free, but a reasonably comfortable end-of-life experience without being zonked out, without being put into some artificial coma, in which they will be able to go on living without this debilitating, frightening pain that is all-consuming. And the truth of the matter is that this in itself would indicate sometimes that it's not so wise to spell out ahead of time whether life support should be discontinued. You know, what a person says at the end, you know, I'll give you an example. A person is 30 years old, and a person looks at someone in their 90s who's walking around bent and has a very hard part of life, and they kind of say when they're 30 and healthy, 25 and healthy, if I had to be like that, I'd rather be dead. But 65 years later, when you find yourself that way, life does have a certain promise, a certain benefit even then. So you have to be careful not to lock yourself up, not to lock your future up into looking at the future from the perspective of where you are now. Things change. Therapies change. Pain management technologies change. Alternative medicine offers promise. People have desires to live, whether it's to take care of a cat or a plant, or to see a granddaughter get married or graduate high school, whatever it is. So there is a certain wisdom in not making decisions for the long term until there is someone that can assess those decisions. So these are some just cautionary notes. Yeah, these are some cautionary notes about the living will. Just to give you an example about, you know, people have a will to live even when life is unbearable. There was a great gadol, Rav Simcha Wasserman, who was Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, also a great gadol. And Rav Simcha Wasserman lived in Los Angeles. And he died without children. He and his wife were married for 60 years. They had no children. And when he died, his wife declared that she had no reason to want to live anymore. But such a great man deserved someone to sit Shiva for him. So she kept herself alive for a week. She sat Shiva. I believe she died the day after Shiva. She essentially willed herself to be alive for that purpose. And ultimately, living wills, physician-assisted suicides, are kind of giving into the culture of despair in the guise of autonomy. It's a funny thing. On one hand, autonomy says you have the right to make decisions. But on the other hand, you should know that the so-called right to die has often been turned into a duty to get out of the way. Because in the modern medical culture that we're in, you will find that when a family and a patient aggressively want to keep going, that type of autonomy isn't respected that much. In other words, autonomy is respected if it's exercised in one direction. and not in the other. And we have court cases, as bizarre as it is, of physicians going to court to have life support discontinued over the objections of the patient on the grounds of what is called medical futility. And that's a fascinating inversion of the notion of autonomy. Autonomy should mean patients have the right to make decisions. And yet, as is often the case, you got to make the politically correct decision. And there's no question that a lot of this is driven by economics of healthcare. It is driven by managed care, which after all, and of course, it is a serious problem. I mean, the problem is one I cannot fully address, and that is a tremendously high percentage of the healthcare budget is devoted to taking care of patients in the last month of life. Now, the truth of the matter is, it's a real problem, because we don't have unlimited resources. And if we have fewer of those people hanging around, we could have more money for prenatal care and for other things. It's a real problem. But what I'm saying is, there's no question that economics and allocation of resources are distorting the notion of autonomy to no longer reflect a patient's wishes, but to almost impose on patients and families the duty to get out of the way. And that's a very, very disturbing development. That's why you see physician-assisted suicides in different countries and in Oregon and the like. But for our purposes, I guess the one simple lesson I'm leaving you with in all of these disjointed reflections is, number one, you should have a living will. Number two, the living will should ensure that decisions were made halakhically. Number three, you should consult and discuss the halakhic parameters with your rav. Number four, the living will should not be overly rigid in specifying everything ahead of time, because you change, your circumstances change, therapies change, and pain management changes. And number five, halakha does recognize the imperative of life. Halakha also recognizes that there are times of great suffering where one is permitted not to push ahead in a very aggressive way. When you strike that exact balance would be part of the discussion that you must have with your posek. So, Be'ezras Hashem, as we enter a new year, I hope that all of us should be inscribed in the Book of Life. But one should know that if, God forbid, tragic decisions have to be made, the Torah does give us guidance and a methodology for making those decisions. Thank you.
Right away, we're now open the floor for a short question and answer session. Please speak loudly.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could, that was a big topic, if you could briefly address the extent to which a halakhically committed physician is obligated to follow those standards for a patient who is not halakhically committed, either a Jew or a non-Jew.
Yes, that's actually a very excellent question. That part I did not address in my remarks, so I'm glad that you brought it up. First of all, let me point out that living wills are legally binding documents. So, for example, if there's a living will that says a certain treatment should be discontinued, which under Jewish law should not be discontinued, if you were to disobey that living will, you would be subject to discharge from the hospital, and you would also be subject to disciplinary proceedings and possible revocation or suspension of a license. So it's a very, very delicate issue. Now, obviously, on one level, our obligations to HaKadosh Baruch Hu are, of course, more important than anything. On the other hand, keep in mind that by and large, the withdrawal of treatment is not, in other words, if you have to classify the halakhic offense, it typically is not actual murder, but it's a violation of the negative commandment, lo samod al dam reyecha, do not stand by idly. And essentially, for a variety of reasons, a doctor would not be obligated to lose his parnasa because of lo samod al dam reyecha. And what I would advise a person is that you should not be involved physically in shutting off the machine or the life support. And if you can simply say you can't make those decisions, they have to be made by some other doctor, which is allowed generally. Just like, for example, in many hospitals, Catholic physicians, not so many Jews ask, that's an amazing thing. We also have laws against abortion, but typically the Catholic physician cannot perform an abortion, the hospital will allow him to get someone else. So that's what you'd have to do. In other words, the point is, you realistically cannot stop that decision from being made. What are you going to do? Are you going to stand in the hospital room when they come to shut off the respirator? they'll call security and drag you out. So the best you can do is simply pass the buck, and you're not mechuyev to endanger your parnasa for that. What you might want to do is, you might at least recommend that the patient discuss it with his spiritual advisor, but you know, what's that going to do if he's not committed to halakha? You know? But I know it's kind of a cop-out, but that's kind of the best you can do. Now, for a non-Jew, things are much easier. For a non-Jew, although we're not allowed to kill non-Jewish patients, but we don't have an affirmative obligation to save them if they don't wish to be saved. So as a result, you can more or less follow a living will for a non-Jew. Yeah.
You mentioned earlier, and I'm just a layman, that if you administer, and I think it was in a minority view of Rabbi Blatt, administer pain medication,
yes,
that will minimize respiratory...
That may minimize,
which
yeah.
could therefore
yes.
send you into cardiac arrest? Am I going to...
Well, the person could die. That's correct. In other words, this is actually Lahavdil. The Catholic Church has a very similar category called double effect, and that is if something is being administered for a legitimate medical purpose, even though it may indirectly hasten an earlier death, it is a permissible medical intervention. I mean, a very good example is surgery. Right? People might die under the table, right? But if you're doing it for a medical purpose, even if it kills the patient, it might kill the patient, it's a morally justified intervention. So Rabbi Blatt says, and as this forms on my other post-game as well, that since the relief of pain is a legitimate and proper medical intervention, the fact that it may, over time, cause respiratory failure or contribute to an earlier death is permitted as long as it is not being done to kill the patient. It's being done to relieve excruciating pain. Now, how do you know? Well, God knows. Right? You're right, we don't know. But God judges us based on the motivation for the treatment. In other words, a patient does not have to avoid pain relief because there's a risk of cardiac arrest or death. Yes?
So, I'm a medical oncologist, and this is actually my day-to-day life is often times with, around these questions.
Yeah.
And with my observant patients, often it comes down, and it's a Blythe versus Denver,
yeah.
you know, debate, but it comes down to whether an intervention I'm proposing, whether a patient will accept DNR or not, comes down to whether an intervention will delay death or prolong life. Now, of course, that comes down to the fundamental definition of what it is to be alive, and hence this big decision. But it can be a bit of a slippery slope as to, you know, when are you delaying death,
yeah.
which then it would be halakhically appropriate to
right.
withdraw care,
right.
and when you are potentially prolonging life. And how does one, as a physician, you know, I talk to the Rav, but, you know, how does one sort of balance this act? Because
yeah.
no one actually knows in certainty which you're doing.
That's very good. Now, you'll notice, as I'm sure you noticed, that I did not use that vocabulary, although it's a very, very common way of describing the situation. Are you causing death, or are you delaying life, or whatever that dichotomy between, extension and terminating? I would prefer to look at it this way. The halakhic imperative is that as long as we can keep people alive, we must keep people alive unless it is counterbalanced by extreme pain and suffering, at which point the Torah permits a compassionate response of allowing the death process to occur naturally with appropriate palliative care. So as far as I would see it, the primary issue at this point is the pain and suffering that the patient is undergoing. That if the intervention can prolong life without causing tremendous pain and distress, and the illness itself, the pain could be controlled, then pikuach nefesh would tend to say we try to keep people alive. And even if people are comatose, and even if people don't seem to be functioning. There are certain missions that the soul may have in this world that are beyond our comprehension, and there normally is an imperative to try to keep people alive. So the basic approach is that it is only the yisurin, it is only the suffering, that is the countervailing factor here. That's how I would approach it. That way you don't really get into the, you don't have to get into the definitional quandary of am I prolonging life or delaying death.
So one of the practical issues comes, someone is suffering and there is a potential clinical trial completely unproven. In fact, it's so unproven, it's called the phase one trial, uh-huh. where the goal of the trial is not, has no therapeutic benefit.
Okay? Yep.
And so I've been asked, you know, from a legal point of view, does, and by the Rob, does the patient have any chance of benefiting? And the goal of the trial is just to find a dose that doesn't
right.
kill patients.
Right, right,
okay?
Right, right.
Does that patient have to live, have to continue their suffering to go on to something that doesn't even have a therapeutic benefit?
Yeah, so here I have to say that even, I should have mentioned this before, even Rabbi Bleich, who is so strict in the vitalist imperative, does make clear that a terminal patient who is in great suffering does not have to utilize experimental or unproven treatments. So I think that would be an exception that even Rabbi Bleich recognizes, so he would not have to.
I have one more question.
Yes, sir. Yeah. You know, I think that this is, you know, it is unconscionable. It is unconscionable and immoral that this shouldn't be defined. I mean, let a hospital define it however they want to define it. I don't care. But there needs to be a clear definition so the family can assess and the Rav can assess what's going to be done and what's not going to be done. I mean, how can anyone issue a psak on a DNR if the meaning of the DNR differs from, you know, emergency room to physician, you know, downstairs, whatever it is. So there is no guidance in American law. I mean, as far as I understand it, but again, I mean, you know better than I, the norm is that DNR is limited to CPR, generally, no CPR, and normally intubation should be employed, particularly when there's a good probability that they'll be weaned off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm
not aware of case law. I would assume that initially this would have to be an internal hospital definition. And I assume professional organizations. You're telling me there is no definition, the AMA or emergency medicine?
I see.
So DNI is a separate order.
DNI is a separate order.
Yeah. Okay. And a DNR alone would not include a DNI, or it would?
No.
It would not. Now you're saying, but you're saying your experience is different.
DNI, it does exist, yeah. But you still have the same debate about whether DNR.
Okay. Okay, so, but according to the gentleman in the back, he says a DNR should not include a DNI, which was my instinct as well. But you're telling me that physicians on the ground don't are not always attuned to that distinction.
That ambiguity is unresolved.
Well, that's very, very unfortunate. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes.
New York State DNR law is very clear, and these are what you made very nice with the distinction between the culture of
yes.
the hospital and what a DNR is interpreted to mean is very different
yeah.
from place to place. But law is very clear that a do not resuscitate order only applies in cardio
yeah.
pulmonary
Yeah.
Should be intubated unless there
well,
is DNR.
I think we need some CMU here, or a CME rather, for that, for that very important issue. Thank you.
Okay. All right, well,